Support for the Morning Show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available online at carthage.edu/grad.
And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We begin today's program by bringing you part two of the conversation which I recorded with award-winning sports writer Michael Leahy, talking about his wonderful new book called The Last Innocents, The Collision of the Turbulent 60s and the Los Angeles Dodgers. The Dodgers were one of the most successful teams in Major League Baseball in the 1960s, but their success played out against a dramatic backdrop of political turmoil and unrest in this country, particularly along the lines of the Civil Rights Movement. It was also an era in which Major League Baseball itself would be dramatically transformed. Where we pick up the interview today is where Michael Leahy begins talking about one of the most pivotal figures in the Dodgers organization, a crusty veteran by the name of Buzzy Bevesi, who was their general manager. It was his responsibility to hammer out the contracts for all of his ballplayers, and he engaged in some fairly deceitful practices in order to hammer out contracts which would pay even his star players as little as possible. It was a practice which ultimately would lead to a rebellion of sorts among baseball players in the major leagues and would really reshape Major League Baseball in a way that was utterly at odds with everything that Buzzy Bevesi stood for. Here's Michael Leahy, the author of The Last Innocents, The Collision of the Turbulent 60s and the Los Angeles Dodgers, talking about their general manager, Buzzy Bevesi.
Buzzy Bevesi was Buzzy Bevesi, the imperious, tight-fisted general manager of the Dodgers in that era, was chief enforcer of the Dodgers owner, Walter O'Malley, who was equally tight-fisted. Just a sentence of preface, Greg. I think you know these two men ought to be. History ought to record that these two men should be admired for their great strides in helping speed the integration of baseball. Since we referenced that, we've been talking about that for a while. O'Malley and Bevesi were committed to seeing full integration of the Dodgers. It happened in the 1950s. You could look out at the Dodgers ball club and see a majority black ball club on the field. And you could see that in the 1960s as well. So O'Malley and Bevesi need to be heralded for all that. But with regard to salary negotiations, the two men could not have been more tight-fisted. Buzzy Bevesi, Greg, was infamously would sometimes seek to deceive players during salary negotiations by placing, if you can believe this, Greg, phony contracts on his desk that would have salary figures of other players on the contract. So if a player like Ron Fairley, the Dodgers right fielder, walked in, he would see the contract of Tommy Davis, the Dodgers star left fielder, on Bevesi's desk with a phony salary figure on it, a figure much lower than Bevesi was actually paying Tommy Davis. And Bevesi would excuse himself from the room, knowing that temptation would take over and that Fairley, who was alone in the room by now, would peer onto Bevesi's desk to see what Bevesi was supposedly paying Tommy Davis. And that's indeed what Bevesi did to Ron Fairley 1 year. Bevesi excused himself, left the room. Fairley looked at this bogus contract on Bevesi's desk, saw what looked to be what Tommy Davis was earning, and it was the very figure Fairley had thought of asking for. But Fairley looked at the figure and thought, my gosh, I don't deserve what Tommy Davis is getting. I can't possibly ask for that. So Bavese got exactly what he wanted. When he returned to his office, Fairley, having seen what Davis was making, lowered his own salary demand by $10,000 to $15,000. So it was that kind of duplicity that ultimately got Bavese in a jam, because he bragged about what he had done to Fairley without using without citing Fairley by name. He bragged about what he had done to Fairley to Sports Illustrated magazine and to other publications. And he bragged about similar tactics he had employed during salary negotiations with other players.
And again, this is years later he's boasting about this. But at the time, this was all absolutely secret.
That's right. That's absolutely right. And the furor that was sparked by Bavese's disclosure of his tactics, the furor sparked in the aftermath of stories that ran in places like Sports Illustrated and the Los Angeles Times and other esteemed publications, helped again to generate the kind of heat that led to the eruption that gave rise to the players' union and ultimately the kind of salary equity that would give players much greater salaries, fairer salaries, and, of course, bedevil O'Malley and Buzzy Bavese.
Mm-hmm. One thing that I think is hard to understand is here's how you spell it out in as you describe what it was like in that period then after the Dodgers win the World Series and their star players begin renegotiating their contract. I mean, because each of them only had a year contract. Nobody back then had such a thing as a multi-year contract at all. So this gauntlet was run again and again. And you're saying here that Wills, Koufax, Drysdale, and others had stardom, whatever that meant, but they had no clout and certainly no financial security, either in Bavese's office or with anyone else. As players, they were hired help. Glamorous and highly sought after help, perhaps, but help just the same, always subject to wealthy and powerful men's orders, and always dependent on their blessing and their money, most of all. I think it's really hard for us to imagine such a scenario, because now we think of the typical baseball star having, I mean, kind of an obscene amount of clout, just nothing to say nothing of an obscene amount of money. And it's just strange to think about a different world of Major League Baseball in which a baseball player could be a star and yet have so little control over their destiny and over what they would be paid.
Mm-hmm. And principally responsible for that, Greg, was the reserve clause. The onerous reserve clause, which bound a player to a team, and he couldn't leave that team unless he either retired from the game or he was traded away by the team. So the reserve clause gave owners and general managers essentially dictatorial control, and the only avenue that a player had to resist that control was to, on his own, conduct a salary holdout, to say, I'm not going to play the next season unless you pay me what I believe I deserve. But even then, the owners and the general managers could say, look, we're paying you X amount of dollars, and in the end, you're either going to sign the contract or you're not going to be playing next season. And because of the reserve clause, they wouldn't be able to go anywhere else. That situation really was the status quo for the Dodgers until early in 1966, before the 66 season had begun. The Dodgers had won the World Series championship in 1965. Sandy Koufax and Don Drysdale had pitched brilliantly, and Koufax and Drysdale struck upon a novel idea. They would not hold out on their own. They would hold out together, with each man saying that he would not sign his contract unless the other man was satisfied as well. So they became their own union of sorts. They were a union of two. And this tactic, this joint holdout, absolutely befuddled and infuriated Walter O'Malley and Buzzy Bavasi, because while they might have been able to get by for a while during the 1960 season without the services of one of those two Hall of Fame pitchers, they could not possibly do without the services of both men. And so Koufax and Drysdale were ultimately able to prevail in that holdout, and they became the first Dodgers in the team's history to receive salaries of $100,000 or above. Each man earned a bit more than $100,000 for that 1966 season, which to your younger listeners, Greg, must sound like an obscenely low figure in an era when, of course, today many stars receive more than $100,000 for one game alone. But this is what Koufax and Drysdale earned for that entire season. But they were what that joint holdout demonstrated, though, was that together players could get something that they couldn't get on their own. And O'Malley, his son, who graciously sat down with me for a lengthy interview, his son Peter O'Malley, told me what alarmed his father Walter O'Malley, so much was that if Koufax and Drysdale could hold out together, what might stop the whole infield from holding out together, or the whole outfield from holding out, or all the pitchers together holding out together? So Walter O'Malley, a very sharp man, could see the danger of some kind of player union ahead. And by that time, as his son talks about, Walter O'Malley began seeing the writing on the wall that a players' union was coming. But we can also, you know, when we look back, this issue involved more than finances. It also, the issue of bargaining power and money also impacted players' health and the well-being of the entire game. And there was no better example of that, Greg, than what happened to Sandy Koufax. We're talking about an era when pitchers pitched not every fifth day, which is the case today, starting pitchers. Starting pitchers worked every 4 days in that era. And owners did not give players, pitchers or infielders or outfielders, anything longer than a one-year contract. So there was no such thing as a multi-year contract. So each year you were playing for your professional life. If you were a pitcher who had brilliantly won 25 games or more just the year before, if you were only to win 5 or 10 games the next season, well, your salary was going to plummet, and you might not be re-signed to another one-year deal. Sandy Koufax knew all this, so he pitched whenever asked. He pitched every fourth day, and sometimes he would pitch on 2 or 3 days' rest when needed. I mean, this man was absolutely selfless, but as Koufax pointed out, too, your salary the next season was entirely tied to your productivity. So Sandy Koufax continued pitching every fourth day, even when his left arm was in serious trouble, in serious pain, in agony. And that eventually caught up with Koufax, who, as your older listeners know, after the 1966 season, a season when he won 27 games, was the Cy Young winner yet again, after that brilliant season, Sandy Koufax retired at the age of 30 with his arthritic left elbow. And arguably, had Sandy Koufax pitched today, someone would have said to him along the lines when he was in his late 20s, let's just sit you down. Let's shut you down for a period here. See what we can do. See what we can do to get this arm a bit healthier and prolong your career. There are questions as to how much could have been done with an arthritic left elbow, but you know there are doctors today who say that had Koufax been able to avail himself of the kind of treatments that are available to pitchers and athletes today, that his career might have been prolonged. So that was one of the effects of the reserve clause too. It meant that men who were not entirely healthy had to take them out or go out on the field, and these players played brilliantly, of course, but it arguably came at some cost to their careers.
Mm-hmm. And that's such a tragedy in so many ways. And you tell us too that it's not just that Major League management, baseball management, treated their players in this way, but also we are seeing it's a perfect storm because it's also an emergence of a new generation of players who played the game with a rather different attitude. You tell us by the late 50s and early 60s, a different breed of ball player had arrived. The newcomers were not depression babies overjoyed just to get a paycheck for playing baseball. They did not necessarily feel, as Lou Gehrig had, like the luckiest men on the face of the earth. Some, like Koufax at moments, had the souls of agonizing artists.
Yeah, they were a different breed. They were innocents, which is why I entitled the book The Last Innocents. They were innocents as they arrived in the game, but that quickly wore off. They could see the change taking place in America around them. They could see the seeds of change in their own game, and they wanted to benefit from that. They wanted to achieve success for themselves on the field, and they wanted to be rewarded for that success off it. Some of the men among my seven principal characters, the seven Dodgers in The Last Innocents, were more skilled and more assertive than others in pushing for their own interests. Koufax was particularly insistent during salary negotiations that he get something approximating what he deserved. Drysdale was that way too. But all of these players, these seven players involved, had dreams of seeing their efforts on the field rewarded with more respect from the baseball establishment and their countrymen too. So, you know, Maury Wills becomes, his evolution during the 60s, I think, is particularly fascinating. Maury would, during the early 60s, sometimes back down during salary negotiations with Buzzy Bavasi, and that reluctance to push as hard as he might have sort of ate at him, and that Buzzy Bavasi got the best of him during some salary negotiations, Maury said, was something that he was determined to correct as the 60s moved along. So to give you an example of Maury's change, at some point Maury was traded away from the Dodgers briefly and found himself with the Pittsburgh Pirates, playing there in 1968. Maury was a huge fan of John Kennedy and Robert Kennedy. And when Robert Kennedy was assassinated in 1968, Maury did not want to play baseball on the weekend of Bobby Kennedy's funeral. There was to be Bobby Kennedy was buried in Arlington National Cemetery on the Saturday following his assassination, and the following day, Sunday, was a national day of mourning in the aftermath of Bobby's assassination. And Maury, by then an infielder for the Pirates, did not want to play on that day. Told the Pirates he did not want to play, and asked to be excused. The Pirates refused, and then raised the stakes by putting Maury in the starting lineup, which forced Maury on his own to refuse to play, which he did. And the Pirates, he was not going to back down this time. He had backed down during salary negotiations with Buzzy Bavasi in the past during his Dodger years, but he did not back down this time, refused to play. The Pirates deemed it an act of insubordination, fined Maury Wills, and word of Maury's stance reached the Kennedy camp. Ethel Kennedy heard about it, Bobby Kennedy's widow, and Frank Mankiewicz, Bobby Kennedy's press secretary, heard about it. Frank Mankiewicz got in touch with Maury and with a couple of other Major League Baseball players who had refused to play on that day, and sent them telegrams of appreciation. And during the off-season, Greg, Ethel Kennedy got in touch with Maury and invited him to lunch at Hickory Hill, the Kennedy estate in a suburb of Washington, D.C., in Virginia, invited Maury to lunch on Hickory Hill along with some other Kennedy intimates. And it's a moment to this day of enormous pride for Maury, who in that instance stood up for what he believed. And by the way, sort of parenthetically, the Dodgers, who had traded Maury away after he had stood his ground in the aftermath of the 1966 season and left Japan, left an exhibition tour that the Dodgers were on because he had a bad leg that needed treatment, and just refused to play on this bad leg during the Dodgers' exhibition games in Japan after the 66 season. The Dodgers saw the error of the ways and traded to get Maury Wills back on the team in the 1969 season. And Maury concluded his career with the Dodgers after the 1972 season.
Hmm. We should mention that this book is a highly personal one, in which you take us into the lives of, in particular, these seven members of the Los Angeles Dodgers, and share such intriguing information about them. As we close, I want you to say a word about someone who we only mentioned once or twice, but whose story I think is particularly intriguing, the story of Wes Parker. He is in such stark contrast in terms of his background and station in life, so to speak. But he had all kinds of ferocious demons that could have so easily ruined his life and ruined his career. And his success story is one of the most gratifying things we read about in your book. say a word about Wes Parker.
It's wonderful you brought up the subject of Wes, Greg. Among my seven principal characters, four of whom are white, three of whom are African-American, Wes Parker stands alone as the one player among these seven players who came from a privileged background. The other six came from backgrounds that ranged from sort of working class to absolutely impoverished. But Wes Parker grew up in an affluent suburb of Los Angeles called Brentwood. It was it could not have been a more glamorous suburb. Wes Parker grew up among motion picture stars on his block and business titans. His father himself was a business titan. Many of your listeners remember the movie Richie Rich. Well, in the 1940s and 50s, Wes Parker as a youth was sort of the embodiment of Richie Rich. And from the outside looking in, it would have looked to neighbors and friends as if Wes Parker, the boy, could not have led a more idyllic youth. But he grew up in a home where he was subjected to regular emotional and physical abuse. So it was an absolutely horrific childhood, and he really wanted to escape the rule of his parents. And so for Wes, he did not want to live off the family money. He really wanted to get away from all that. And so for Wes, baseball was nothing less than his salvation. Hmm. And the book, we first see Wes in the book in 1962 after his college graduation. By this time, Greg, Wes, who had played ball in college and high school but had not been signed to a contract by any professional scouts, Wes had not played baseball for more than a year. And after his college graduation, being the rich playboy he was, he had run off to Europe to chase women largely, but he was feeling awful about himself. He had no direction in life. He didn't want to live off his parents' money. His self-esteem could not have been lower. He had no idea what he was going to do next. And he was sitting in a Paris hotel room waiting on yet another woman when a wild idea struck. It hit him with the force of an epiphany. And the next thing he knew was he was running in the rain on the Paris streets to a TWA ticket office. He bought himself a plane ticket. He left a note for the woman who was coming to meet him saying he had to go home. He flew back to Los Angeles, got off the plane, called the Los Angeles Dodgers, and asked for a tryout. And the man who had returned the call, a former Dodger manager and by then a coach named Charlie Dressen, an amused Charlie Dressen, said to a young Wes Parker, kid, this isn't exactly the way it works. People don't just call us and ask for tryouts. We don't know what you have. But an amused Charlie Dressen offered at least to – he wasn't going to sign Wes Parker to any even minor league contract, but he said to Wes Parker, look, if you want to play, there's this knock-around winter league in Los Angeles where amateurs and some people who used to play the game in college and high school and some ex-minor leaguers get together and play ball, and sometimes scouts come out, and if you have something, who knows? It's unlikely to happen, Wes, but you have nothing to lose, and if you want to, I'll set you up. And And that's what Charlie Dressen did. Wes Parker played in this knock-around winter league in 1962. Nobody went to see these games. They didn't have fans. They played on recreational fields around Los Angeles in public parks. And once in a while, a couple scouts would come out. In 1962, while all this was going on, Greg, the Cuban Missile Crisis happened, Wes Parker demonstrated in that moment the singular concentration that would come to define him. And Wes Parker played well in this winter league, so well that a Dodger scout offered him a minor league contract. And that led to Wes Parker's ascension. And so improbably, 19 months after he sat in that Paris hotel room with no idea what he was going to do with his life, just 19 months after that, Wes Parker found himself in the major leagues. He was the 9,830th player in baseball history ever to play in the major leagues. And as I say in the book, probably the most unlikely.
Yes. And of course, what's so interesting and important about his story is that on the surface, here is someone who seemed to have everything. I mean, incredibly handsome and charismatic and athletically talented and has money in his pocket, and yet an intensely unhappy, conflicted young man. I mean, just haunted by pervasive feelings of unworthiness. I mean,
right.
The scars of kind of uncaring or insensitive parenting and so on, and personal demons that he kept completely hidden from his even his teammates, and it's in a sense a story somewhat similar to Maury Wills's, that here Wes Parker manages to achieve incredible success despite the fact that he is doing so burdened with all of this emotional pain.
That's absolutely right. And in Wes, we're talking about this white player, again, from this privileged background. And he hid, as you point out, Greg, he hid all these demons from his teammates out of concern that if his teammates knew what was plaguing him, that they might lose confidence in him, that they might believe he didn't possess the requisite mindset to succeed in Major League Baseball. And by this time, he was the starting first baseman for the Los Angeles Dodgers. So they had no idea, and yet it was a constant source of agony for Wes, a constant challenge. And the challenge was even greater for him when he was playing in Los Angeles. Sometimes when he was on the road, surrounded by all his teammates at meals and going out for a drink here or there, he could lose himself in their camaraderie. And they were a source of strength for him. But when he was at home in Los Angeles on game days, his self-doubt often was such that he didn't want to go to the ballpark for the game that night. He feared that if he were to go hitless in a game that night, in a big game, that he might be exposed as the failure that his mother in particular always suggested he would be. And so his fear of failure was such that on some days he didn't want to go to the ballpark. It would take all his power to push himself out of a chair in his home, rush to his car, and before he had time to change his mind, start driving for Dodger Stadium. Once he reached the stadium was something of a refuge. He would be surrounded by his friends again. He could get back in the proper mindset. But to be at home on some of those game days was agonizing when those demons would start plaguing him again. Mm. So his ability to fight through that was the central challenge in his career, and comprises a central part of the passages about him in The Last Innocence.
It's a wonderful story. All of these ball players each have their own compelling story, and it reminds us all not to paint with too broad a brush when we think about professional athletes. Each of them an individual, each of them wrestling with maybe complexities in their own past or present, and whenever an athlete manages to surmount those challenges, it's something we can all take inspiration from. The book, again, is entitled The Last Innocence, The Collision of the Turbulent 60s and the Los Angeles Dodgers. It is published by Harper, an imprint of HarperCollins, and the author, Michael Leahy. Michael Leahy, I loved this book, and I learned so much from it. And I hasten to add, I'm not even a particularly rabid baseball fan. And I only say that because I think there is so much to be enjoyed in this book, even if one is not particularly fanatical about the game of baseball. It's an important book on so many levels, and I really hope people will seek it out. And I thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it. I've enjoyed this.
Thanks for the kind words, Greg, and thanks so much for having me.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. Part two is coming up in just a moment. On two previous occasions, I've had the great pleasure of speaking with Rick Steves, who is, of course, one of the best-known, maybe the best-known travel expert, travel advisor in the country right now, and responsible not only for interesting work on public television, but also for all kinds of different travel guides and books. And now, a very exciting new kind of resource designed for those who would tour through Europe and experience it in a very different way. Rick Steves' Walks and Tours ebooks, which allow visitors to Europe to, in a sense, take themselves on self-guided excursions with the help of Rick Steves in this particular way. It's a wonderful idea, and we're going to talk with Rick Steves about this intriguing idea. Rick Steves, we welcome you back to The Morning Show.
Pleasure to be with you, Greg.
Did anything in particular prompt this idea?
Well, it's just exciting, all the digital, the ways we can take information and get them to people digitally. A lot of people like to have their information on their cell phone these days so they don't have to lug around a big book. And we've got a wealth of information in all of our different, I write and update 30 different guidebooks to Europe. And my publisher had this great idea of offering all the 70 different chapters from these books that are not the hotels and restaurants and not what's happening after dark and not all the shopping tricks and so on, but just here's a tour of Westminster Abbey, here's a tour of Venice's Lagoon, here's a tour of the Uffizi Gallery in Florence or the Topkapi Palace in Istanbul. So if somebody's in a town for a quick visit or if they've got another guidebook they like and they just want my self-guided tour, I think that's one thing that distinguishes my books is I've got, I come from a heritage of being a tour guide. For 25 years I was taking groups around Europe, and I love to provide these sort of self-guided tours. So we had this almost, I'd say, the top 70 tours you could do in Europe, built into all my different guidebooks. And now with this new technology, we can just offer them for $2 each in this sort of format, and I think it's pretty exciting.
Absolutely. So first of all, what kind of devices are we talking about in which someone can experience these e-books?
Well, you can read them on your e-reader or tablet, but they're specifically designed for a smartphone. And the trick is, the smart thing is to download them onto your phone before you go to avoid roaming charges, and then all that information stored. And then when you finally get to Paris and you want to walk through the left bank, you just pull it out and you've got your guided tour right there.
And what sort of format does this self-guided tour follow?
I mean, it would be just basically, if I was to walk you through Anne Frank's house and remind you, give you a little context, and then remind you what to see in this room, and then what happened in that room, and where to look out and appreciate, you know, what she was going through in this room, it would just be like I was walking you through that site, but you wouldn't have me there. You would just be reading it on your iPhone.
So we read the text and sort of follow the directions in terms of when
right.
to go where.
That's right. Now, I also do audio tours, which are entirely free, and they're on my Rick Steves Audio Europe app. And this is something I've put a lot of energy into in the last few years, and we've got about 30 different two-hour guided walks. And this has been really fun for me as a tour guide, and tens of thousands of people are getting this app and running around Europe enjoying these free tours. And I like these because you've just got me in your ear, and then you're just sort of immersed in the wonder of the Sistine Chapel or the Louvre, and you don't have to, you know, be reading your book and looking up, but I just get the joy of walking you through as if I was at your side and explaining to you everything that you might want to understand about that particular site. In this app, we've got all of the most important walks and tours for Venice, Florence, Rome, Paris, London, Athens, Vienna, the Rhine River, Ephesus, Assisi, all my favorite tours. And that's been a lot of fun. I've got a radio show, a weekly hour on public radio, and we've just taken 7 years of this hourly show, deconstructed the shows, and designed all the various interviews into country-specific playlists. And then somebody who's going to Norway or Portugal or Ireland, they can just go to the up into the cloud with this app and tick which countries they're going to and grab all the information that relates to that country. That's kind of nice, Greg, because you're stuck in the traffic jam or you're on a long plane ride or you're in your hotel room and your travel partner is sleeping and you really want to prepare for tomorrow. You can listen to these different interviews and tours and get more out of your visit.
As you put together these mini e-books that we're talking about, more specifically today, the 70 plus that
right.
take us through these important tour sites, did any particular philosophy guide you in putting these together? I mean, in terms of the kind of things you talk about, the way in which you want people to experience these sites?
Yeah, I think it's important when you look at a site to understand it in the historical context. So, you know, if you're in my favorite collection of paintings in Europe, the Prado, it's nice to know how the King of Spain, why he amassed all of these great paintings. One of my favorite painters is Bosch, and he painted up in the Netherlands. Why would the best Bosch paintings be down in Madrid? Well, because back when Bosch was working, his country was called the Spanish Netherlands, and it was ruled by Spain. And consequently, the best art from Holland or the Netherlands ended up down in Madrid. Centuries later, we can kind of get a sense of how important the King of Spain was by the fact that he's got the great masterpieces from all over the place in his city. You know, that kind of helps. Also, just to know the sweep of history, it's interesting to know that you know, when the Eiffel Tower was being built and there was all this erector set art, people were a little tired of right angles and they got into this curvy, slinky, organic Art Nouveau. Well, that makes sense. And if you're looking at Art Nouveau, it's nice to know the context. So that's what a tour guide tries to do. And then also a tour guide wants to make sure that, you know, when you go to the Borghese Gallery, you know, your admission is good for 2 hours. The Bernini statues are by far the most important, but the crowds are really big there first. Why don't you go upstairs and see the paintings, get them out of the way, and then you can administer your precious time more carefully down below with the highlights of the collection without all the so many crowds. These are strategic little tips that, as a tour guide, you know, you pick up. And as I mentioned, for 25 years I was a tour guide, and I know the frustration of getting a two-hour window of of opportunity in a museum and mismanaging your time and never getting to the treasure that you really went to that museum to see before they kick you out. So these are the, there's all sorts of, that's just travel tips. That's what guidebooks are for. So I've been, I spend 4 months a year in Europe checking out all this information. I was just in Venice and using my own tours. It's kind of funny to have me listening to myself with my little iPhone buds, but I get used to my voice, and I forget a lot of stuff, and then I get to learn it again when I hear me giving me the tour. I also get to look at lines. I was just walking by the line at the Basilica of San Marco in Venice, and it's a two-hour-long line. It forms an hour before the church opens, and I know a tip. I talk about it in my Rick Steves Venice book that says if you've got a little bag, check it at the bag check, which is 100 yards away from the church. They give you your receipt for having left a bag there. You can take that receipt directly to the turnstile, and the guard will let you go in without waiting in that line. It's free. It saves you 2 hours. That's just the mark of a smart traveler. As far as I'm concerned, there's two IQs of European travelers, those who wait in lines and those who don't. So I like people to learn from my mistakes rather than their own and travel smoother, and I think that's why people enjoy using my travel information, whether it's in the standard print form or whether it's in some of these new exciting digital formats.
One thing I wonder is, I suspect you have a mini ebook even for something as huge and complex as the Louvre versus other sites where we're talking about something that, in a sense, in terms of dimension and complexity, is a little more modest. Is it a challenge to try to put a mini ebook together about something as vast as, for instance, the Louvre?
Well, the nice thing about digital information, there's no page count. When I'm doing writing a book in print and my publisher wants to make some money on it, he says, Rick, we got to limit this to 350 pages. With an ebook, it can be, once you've made it, it doesn't cost any more to deliver to somebody, unlike print. So to answer your question, we've got 73 different of these Rick Steves walks and tours in their ebook format. Some of them would be the equivalent of 40 pages, and some of them would be the equivalent of 100 pages, and they all just cost $2 each.
Very good. So if people want more information, they, I believe, should go to your website, www.ricksteves.com. Anything else they need to know in terms of accessing this wonderful new resource?
Well, thanks for asking. You can get the ebooks in the standard places, the Apple iBookstore, the Amazon Kindle Store, BN.com, and other ebook retailers. And you can learn more about it just by Googling Rick Steves and checking that out. The app I've got is entirely free. It's just Rick Steves Audio Europe. You get it at the App Store. It's good for Androids and for iPhones. And the print books are, of course, available in local bookstores. But most important, people need to realize if they take that planning part of their trip seriously, they'll get the absolute most out of every minute and every dollar they're investing in their vacation. And I'm just really happy to help out.
Rick Steves, thank you so much. Best wishes to you. Safe travels.
Thanks. Talk to you again, Greg.
Bye-bye. Bye.
.58 now, 2 minutes before 9 o'clock. A reminder, support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's is at 2401 60th Street, Kenosha. Online at andreasgifts.com. Support for the morning show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information online at carthage.edu/grad. News headlines coming up at a minute past 9. Let's check the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service between now and then. Today, Wednesday the 20th, partly sunny, hot and humid. A high today of 87. Perspective on that number. Normal high this time of year would be 80. The record high for this date, 100 degrees, July 20th, 1930. Tonight, then, partly cloudy and warm. Low dropping back.